Come and Get It is the highly anticipated new novel from New York Times bestselling and award-winning author Kylie Reid. A fresh and provocative story about a college RA and her messy entanglement with a professor and three unruly students. Come and Get It is an intimate portrait of consumption, desire, and reckless abandon. Look for Come and Get It, available from Putnam, wherever books are sold.
Hello, everyone. I'm Gilbert Cruz, and this is the Book Review Podcast. You're about to hear a discussion I had last year with Sarah Lyle, a writer-at-large at the New York Times. For those of you who keep track of bylines in the Book Review, you know that she's also the person behind our regular thriller column. Our talk was prompted by an idea I had had at the time. I was thinking about the books that people read over and over and over again. I was thinking about those books in my life. And I got curious about the books that others, writers, artists, creative people of all stripes, carry with them throughout their lives. What are the books that they reread, and what does it say about them? Luckily, I got the chance to talk about this with Sarah. We've never aired this conversation before, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello!
Hi, good morning!
Where are you coming from?
I have just been at the Westminster Kennel Club dog show
Sarah is a writer at large. She covers things like the Westminster Dog Show. She writes about the royal family. She writes amazing celebrity profiles. And she has a regular column in the New York Times Book Review on thrillers. What an amazing job you have.
I have a really fun job. I'm really lucky, and I sort of hope nobody notices, so I get to keep doing it.
Sarah's book is A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline L'Engle.
I'm very excited to talk to you about this book.
How many times have you read it?
I read it so many times when I was a kid. And interestingly enough, I used to write my name in it every time I read the book. And I probably had 10 signatures there, and I could watch my signature change, and I could try new types of signature, and I tried cursive, and I tried capitals, and I put a little flourish next to it.
So wait, every time you picked up, you just wrote your name again?
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I've never heard that before.
I don't know. I had a lot of conversations with myself when I was that age. So maybe that was part of my, monologue dialogue with my own brain.
When did you first read A Wrinkle in Time?
Well, I was 9 years old and I was living in New York City.
And had you picked it up from the library? Did you buy it yourself? Did you ask your parents to buy it for you? How did you come into ownership of this book?
I don't actually remember that. I know that we did have that great thing at school that you could order books from the Scholastic magazine or whatever it was. Did you have that too?
I absolutely did. They had the sort of newsprint guides, and you could mark on the back which books that you wanted.
You could mark on the back, and I would always mark a zillion of them, and then my mom would be like, you can only buy 6 or 7 or whatever it was. So I'm pretty sure I must have gotten it through then, because of course we had a library at school, but I know I own my own copy.
Tell me a little bit about this book.
So the book is written by Madeline L'Engle. It was published in 1962. And at its most basic, it's about a girl, Meg, who's 13, who has a younger brother, Charles Wallace, who I think is 6. He's little. And their father has been missing for the last 2 years. Their parents are scientists. He was working for the government on some top secret scientific mission. He hasn't come home. The rumor is that he ran off, but the family believes that it had something to do with his work. So Meg and Charles Wallace and a schoolmate of Meg's, Calvin, then meet these three extraordinary beings who are called Mrs. Who, Mrs. What's It, and Mrs. Witch, who turn out to be extraterrestrial creatures. And these three women tell them that the father has been taken to another planet and is being held captive. And they go on a quest that takes them through different planets. And they finally find themselves face to face with an extraordinary embodiment of evil that they have to somehow defeat so they can rescue the father.
Do you recall? I mean, you were 9. So maybe you only recall a little bit, but do you recall what it was about the book that appealed to you that first time?
It had a fantastic heroine. She's really smart, but sort of unkempt. She has, you know, messy hair. She has glasses. She has braces. People think she's weird, but she's smart, but she's not popular. And she doesn't know how to get along in the world the way you're supposed to at that age. But what really happens in the book that I think resonated with me that I realize now is that it's a book about two children who've lost their father. And I read the book quite soon after my father died. He died when I was 8, and it was a really lost time. And I think what mostly appealed to me about the book was the notion that you actually could get your father back, and that you as the girl who felt so clueless, actually had means within yourself to pull yourself together and be brave enough to do it.
Can I ask you, if you're comfortable, a few questions about your dad, if you can say, how did he pass and what was that like at the time?
So he was 61. He was a doctor. He was a really nice dad. He was pretty old-fashioned, and he died suddenly. He had a heart attack. We were a young family. My mom was very young and hadn't ever really had to deal with most of the stuff on her own that she suddenly had to deal with, you know, finances and all the apparatus of running a family that she had left to my dad. So the difficulty of those few years was really compounded by her bewilderment and her sadness over what had happened. And I think at the time I felt I was pretty old, but when I think of an 8-year-old now and a 9-year-old, my brother was 9, we were tiny. We had no clue. So it was lonely, pretty sad time.
The mom in this book is described at least once as very sad, which is totally understandable. Meg says at one point, she sees her mom sitting in her office writing a letter to the father, which she does almost every day, if not every day. And I'm wondering if at some point that description resonated with you, given your home situation at the time.
I think it did. I think, you know, she's an ideal parent in this book because she's wise. She is sad herself, but she doesn't let her sadness infect her children. And she talks about how she feels with them, but she doesn't use them to try to make herself feel better. And I think I slightly wished for that at the time. I do not fault my mother. She was so young, but her grief made her unable really to be there in the way that Meg's mom is there for her in this book. She was much more, it was really raw grief, and she left us sort of to our own devices more. So I think that is a really, I actually never even thought of that before about this book, that I loved this wonderful family that they had. And there's another character in the book, as you know, Calvin, who befriends the family and becomes part of this adventure. And he is a really interesting character, partly because he's handsome and popular. He's good at sports. He's good at school. But there's a really poignant moment in the book where they meet this wonderful character who says, "I bet you're missing your family. Let's just look in and see what's happening with your family right now." And she shows the mother of Meg doing her lovely stuff at home. I mean, I think she's writing the letter and she's sad, but it's a comforting moment. And then when she looks in on Calvin's house, Calvin comes from a family that's struggling with a lot of issues. It looks like, you know, the house is a mess. The mother's yelling at the kids. There's no love in that household. So it's a really neat contrast. And it's lovely to see Calvin join this other family to some extent and to feel that you can have other parental figures that can take the place of your parents if things aren't going well at home.
One of the interesting ways in which Calvin, the character, works in the book is that he, I think at one point, Lengel says that unlike Calvin, who has these home difficulties but presents at school as very popular, Meg can't hide herself, which is why, you know, from very early in the book, Meg is presented as very emotional, stubborn, difficult. But one of the reasons it feels to me that Meg is such a great character is because she is presented so rawly. You always have, as a reader, constant contact with her emotions, which are always on the surface.
And she stands up to authority in a way. She's like basically F this. I'm not going to listen to my school principal who's telling me what to do. These rules are dumb. And one really great moment in the book comes when she gets into a fight with a kid at school because he, I think, has said something mean about her parents. You know, the rumor at school is that her dad ran off with some hot research assistant or something, and everyone is kind of mean to her about it. And so she has an altercation with this kid, and her mother describes getting a call with a complaint about her and saying, you know, my son came home and has like a black eye because your daughter hit him. And instead of doing what I'm afraid my mom would have done, which would be to punish me, Meg's mom sticks up for her and says, well, you know, given that your son is like a foot taller than my daughter and weighs, you know, 25 pounds more, I'm really surprised he was even, you know, involved in this in the first place. And basically just says, so I'm not accepting your view of my daughter as a belligerent person who started this whole thing.
Thank you, Sarah. We'll be right back.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece, and in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Welcome back to the Book Review Podcast. Here's more from my conversation with Sarah Lyle about A Wrinkle in Time. Have your children read the book? Have you read it to them? Have they?
I have read it. I did read it to them. They loved it. Not as much. I mean, no one loves it as much as I do, I don't think. And they, you know, there's a few books I've read to them where I cannot not cry at certain passages. And it's always a tough moment for the kids to have to listen to me struggling to get the words out. But this was a fun book to read to them. It really was.
I, over the course of the pandemic, the first year of the pandemic, read my son, who's almost 8 now.
Oh, you're so lucky to have a little kid.
All of the Harry Potter books. That's
fantastic.
A lot. But we did over the course of a year. And we got to the last book, The Deathly Hallows. And there's a scene, I believe it's in the last book, when Harry finally visits Godric's Hollow. He goes to his parents' grave and he's describing imagining them below and not knowing that he is there. And I lost it. I just started crying while reading to my child, and he was troubled. Like, he had never really seen me cry in that way. He's like, Daddy, are you okay? Like, it's okay. We're just going to take a break. I'm just going to step out and then I'll come back in. But that was my first experience. I'm sure I'll have more. I think I was imagining myself in a grave. I was imagining my child visiting my grave. It was a lot of very quickly. But back to A Wrinkle in Time. Let's imagine that we are with Mrs. Who and Mrs. What's It and Mrs. Which, and they're allowing us to see scenes that we normally wouldn't be able to see. And they're showing you moments that you have read this book. We're just dropping in at all the times you've read it. What were those moments like? How did you receive this book differently when you were a little bit older?
I think the first one would be when I realized it was really about my father and losing a father. And I read it every few years. There's a few books that I go back to because they're like old friends. I was fixated briefly in early adolescence on the moment where Calvin grabs Meg and roughly kisses her. And I was like, that's the most romantic thing I've ever heard. I can't wait for a boy to roughly kiss me. I don't mean the rough part. I mean that he didn't know what he was doing. Like he's just, and it's a quick kiss goodbye when he's sending her off to do something really scary. And then there was just the pleasure of reading it to my girls. And then I found myself that first hard year of the pandemic, I started listening to audiobooks for the first time because I was trying to go outside and take walks all by myself, the way so many of us were. And I came across the audiobook of A Wrinkle in Time, and I walked up and down Brooklyn Bridge Park for hours each day listening to it. And that was completely new.
How did you receive it during the pandemic? What was it about the book that was comforting in this completely new and bizarre scenario?
So part of it was listening to the language again, remembering so many of these lines that I almost knew by heart. But then there's a moment in there that really hit me. And I was walking through the park sobbing as I walked. I don't cry this much all the time. But there's a moment where the three ladies are describing to the kids what is going on in the universe. And they talk about our planet, about the planet Earth being a young planet and a new planet and hidden behind a dark shadow. And I know now that when she wrote about it, she was talking really about communism and the fight against communism. And that's what I'm sort of putting aside in this discussion of it, because I saw it a different way when I was hearing it. She says that, and then she says, but there's people who are fighting. And she names a couple of them, and it's mostly scientists and artists. So it's like Copernicus, and it's Madame Curie, and it's Shakespeare. They mention Jesus. And I started feeling very dramatic early in the pandemic and thinking about the people who were so bravely trying to keep it together. You know, people trying to develop a vaccine, politicians who were like standing up to some of the weirdness and trying to be good people. And that was really moving to me, this notion that there's people who, in the face of something so extraordinary and so frightening, are like out there fighting. They were saying kind of that the fight is the heroism, and that's almost good enough. You almost don't have to succeed as long as you try. And I thought that was so beautiful.
Has this book, over the course of your life, made you want to be more of that type of person?
I sort of wish I could. I don't think I'm that equipped for it. I don't feel like I'm a public person in that way, but I do feel it helps you be quietly heroic, you know, just do the right thing, just be good to the people around you, stick to your values, fight against things that you're able to fight against in a small way. And I think the best books like this make you at least present an ideal to you that makes you a better person. And one of the great things too about the kids in this book and everyone in this book, and that's resonant for now too, is that they're using intellect and science and facts and their understanding of what freedom means and their understanding of literature to fight against this evil.
One of the things that resonated with me while reading this book as an adult, which I just reread it, was a moment later in the book when Meg is looking to her father to have all the answers, to solve the problem. And there comes a point when she realizes, and he says it himself, he doesn't have the answers. He cannot solve this problem. He is just a fallible human being. Just because he is her parent doesn't mean that he is a god, and she actually has to figure this out on her own. Never would have resonated with me, really, I think, as a kid. But now, as an older person, as a parent who often has to harshly realize I don't have all the answers for my kid, it really stood out to me.
And the fascinating thing about that is it happens to all of us as parents, but how do you deal with that when it comes to your kids? How much do you tell them about that? How much do you let them see that you're struggling as well? And where do you have to just struggle by yourself without letting them see that. And I think the pandemic certainly did that for all of us, no matter how old our kids are, because we want to be strong people who reassure our children. And it was hard to reassure the kids when life seemed to be so upended. And I agree with you. I think that's an amazing moment in there, but it's actually so empowering for Meg because she realizes not only does she have to do it herself, you know, end up solving this problem, but she can do it. And that's a great gift for a parent to give a child to say, I don't have all the answers. I love you so much. And I'm going to support you as you try to work this through yourself.
Right.
And there's a great view in this book of life as a sonnet, you know, and this a sonnet has very specific parameters for how it should be written. But within the strictures of the sonnet, you can write your life however you want it. And that's really beautiful also.
I love that you love this book so much.
Thank you. I appreciate that you wanted to talk about it like this.
It's been a real delight.
Thank you, Gilbert. I hope we get to do this again, but we'll have to find another book next time.
That was my conversation with Sarah Lyle, recorded last year and previously unaired, about the book that she's read the most in her life, Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time. I'm Gilbert Cruz, editor of The Book Review. Thank you for listening.
What do 8 bags of concrete mix, a cooler full of 30-pound sea bass, and a 10-inch compound miter saw have in common? They're all things that are easier to load in and out of the bed of the new F-150, thanks to its new available Pro-Access tailgate that's also a swing gate. The new 2024 Ford F-150, tough this smart, can only be called F-150.
Available starting early 2024, Pro-Access tailgate available starting spring 2024, cargo and load capacity limited by weight and weight distribution.